Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, the New York Island, the Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 366, recorded on Sunday, April 18th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And joining me on the line from New York City is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill and Rachel.
This week, we're going to be talking about the Great Railroad Strike of 1922, or maybe more properly called the Shopman's Strike of 1922. Tried to find various sources that we could go over on this. We want to emphasize up front that, as we'll discuss later, the Wikipedia article on this strike is quite bad. If you want to learn more about this strike, that's not really a good place to look into it. One of the things we try to do is usually make a quick scan of the Wikipedia article about something to figure out the sort of overall structure of an event or something like that, and then go find the necessary sources to really get into the details on that. And that really didn't work for us this week because there were just so many problems with the Wikipedia article on this strike. It's just incomplete and inaccurate, as we'll talk about. So I just wanted to mention that before we really get into this. But it is an interesting strike, and it has a lot of good tie-ins to other recent episodes that we've done. And those episodes also allowed us to sort of get a fuller picture of the situation when talking about this one. So as I said, the Great Railroad Strike of 1922, also called the Railway Shopman's Strike, represents a much more widespread sequel to the disastrous 1911 Shopman's Strike on the Illinois Central and Harriman System Railroads that Kelly and I covered on episode 354 in February 2021. This strike in 1922 also marks the end of the big strike wave that followed World War I, and it occurred in the new legal environment of the 1916 Adamson Act on rail worker labor protections that we discussed on the most recent bonus episode, number 365. But that affected train operators, not, as far as I could tell, repair shop workers, which is going to prove to be important. This strike in 1922 also occurred in the aftermath of wartime nationalization of all of the railroads in the United States temporarily in 1917, at the end of 1917, and then the post-war reprivatization in 1920 that we discussed in episode 224 from 2018 on the U.S. Railroad Administration. So both of those factors, the temporary nationalization and then the reprivatization after the war, are huge influences on the factors for this strike happening in the first place. Wages had been better under federal government control during the war, although that was somewhat offset by wartime inflation of the price of goods and services. But the cut in wages in 1921 after reprivatization really stung the workers, and that was approved by the federal government. It's critical to note here that there had been a 1920 agreement to establish what amounted to sectoral bargaining rights by the American Federation of Labor for all of the nation's rail shop workers. And that began to fall apart as soon as the new, less labor-friendly administration under Harding, Coolidge, and Attorney General Harry Dougherty took office in 1921. And we'll talk about that more as we go through. But the other thing that obviously happens here is that the Railway Labor Board, which is going to be an important player in this, under the control of the Harding administration in that reprivatization era, approved those wage cuts, thereby triggering the strike. So, Kelly, could you go over some of the key strike data on this before we get into the sort of narrative arc of what happened?
Absolutely. And as Bill mentioned, it was really hard to find information on this, and I wonder if one of the reasons is just that there were so many players involved. At the time, there were 16 railway labor organizations in existence, and 7 of those 16 organizations participated in this strike, which means there was about 400,000 people, at least 100,000 people in the Chicago area alone participated. Throughout the course of the strike, and this is another number where it's hard to figure out exactly what happened, but it seems like at least 10 people were killed, mostly strikers or families of the strikers, just to give you an idea about the violence that did escalate that we will touch on later on. Of the 16 railway labor organizations at the time, there were 4 that were considered the Big Four. These unions were the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen and Engineermen, and the Order of Railway Conductors, and the Brotherhood of the Railroad Trainmen. So these were the Big Four unions at the time. These 4 unions were not affected by the wage decrease that kicked off this strike, so they chose not to participate in the strike. This strike really began as a result of wage cuts. After the war, there was an increase in available labor with people who had formerly been in the armed services returning to civilian life. And the war had seen much inflation, which was beginning to correct itself. And so the RLB, the Railroad Labor Board, gave permission to cut wages by 7 cents, which was equivalent to a decrease of 12%. It's important to note that this strike, like other areas of American life at the time, also included elements of race and race tension and discrimination. And so I'm going to read a brief quote here from the Wikipedia article. Railway workers were divided not only by craft, however, but also by race. Several of the railway brotherhoods denied African-American workers membership in their ranks on strictly racial grounds. The excluded workers had no economic or moral incentive to honor the work stoppage. Thousands of Black railway workers crossed picket lines and helped to undermine strike efforts, but that was not universal. In places like North Carolina, Louisiana, and El Paso, Texas, Black workers actively supported the work stoppage. So as we move forward and talk about the arc of this strike and the events of the strike and these 400,000 people who participated, just important to keep in the back of our minds the elements of discrimination and racial tension that clouded this event and so many others throughout American history. One other note as we talk about this strike is that the strikes did become violent at some point. As I mentioned up top, at least 10 people were killed. It's really hard to know here what is truthful and what is not. But there were reports of strikers sabotaging rail cars and railways, reports of company guards shooting strikers and sort of being given permission to be as violent as they needed to be, and the involvement of local law enforcement and state guard troops, which, as we've talked about in previous strikes, certainly result in the escalations of tensions and violence.
The strike was launched July 1st, 1922, and lasted through nearly all of October, despite a court injunction on September 1st, and there were pockets of ongoing strike action continuing in September, October, and even later than October with some of the less conciliatory railroads. Now, as I said up top, the Wikipedia article is basically just wholly incorrect on this point. They suggest that the strike ended in August, at the end of August, because of that September 1st court injunction. But in fact, the strike actually got bigger, with more allied strikes from unrelated unions joining in solidarity after that injunction. We'll talk about more about why that was so inflammatory in a bit. And this eventually led to what we'll talk about also in a few moments, the Baltimore Agreement in mid-September between the unions and 50 railroads, which was eventually adopted by 126 railroads by the end of October. So some consider the strike to have been a failure. And in fact, the Wikipedia article basically just writes this whole strike off as a total failure. And there is some truth to that in the sense that the workers' initial demands were largely not met. And we'll talk about what they actually got out of the conciliation agreement at the end. But contemporary accounts, such as a December 1922 Monthly Labor Review article, which we will link to in the notes at arsenalfordemocracy.com, as always. The contemporary accounts suggest that at the time, this strike was viewed as more of a draw. So Yes, the workers did give up most of their pre-strike demands, but they were able to successfully protect their workers' rights to get back to work without the loss of seniority, with first 50 and then eventually 126 railroads making gestures toward reconciliation in the Baltimore Agreement signed in mid-September. They might, as they did in past strikes, have skipped out on reconciliation in favor of a crushing victory over workers. A September 1922 article in the Railway Age argued that the strike had been very costly and damaging for the railroads and would hopefully motivate moderates among both owners and unions to seek a more conciliatory labor peace strategy for the years to follow. Also, one thing you cannot deny about this strike is that it was a successful, huge show of organizational force by the unions to achieve a nationwide 400,000-person simultaneous walkout with a nearly 100% participation rate among the unions that had voted to strike, even if it didn't win much of anything. And I think that's a huge comparison or contrast point to make, as we'll talk about later, with that 1911 strike of shop workers on the Illinois Central Railroad and the Harriman system. That strike, as Kelly and I talked about on that episode, was a huge fiasco that basically resulted in not only a defeat of all of their demands, but basically made the union shown to be a paper tiger, and everyone basically lost their jobs. And that did not happen here. So the strike actually went on longer than it probably needed to after it was clear that the unions had sort of lost their strategic objectives, because the union, as strong and huge as it was able to make essentially a tactical retreat to protect themselves from being destroyed by this strike failing. Some of the railroads tried to strip the strikers of their seniority rights under their contracts, and the Railway Labor Board claimed that strikers had forfeited their arbitration rights guaranteed under the Transportation Act of 1920 that reprivatized the railroads. Now, as Rachel is about to explain, this point about seniority ended up becoming a major sticking point in terms of getting back to work and ending the strike, because the initial position of the railroads, backed by the federal government, was that if you had striked, you had essentially quit your job, and if they rehired you, they didn't have to respect your previous contractual seniority and the various perks and benefits that came with that under your contract. And again, although the pre-strike demands were not met, they were able to essentially resolve the strike in favor of not facing any consequences, really, for having gone out on strike. So, Rachel, could you talk a little bit more about that from that same article in the Monthly Labor Review from December 1922?
Yeah. So Margaret Gadsby kind of continually pointed out throughout the article that it was really the reluctance of the carriers to negotiate and comply with the attempted mediation by the Railway Labor Board. Their reluctance to arbitrate the matter really drew out the strike longer than it had to be. So like we said, the strikers were willing to engage in good faith negotiations and even give up their demands, but that seniority issue just became a real sticking point. So like you mentioned earlier, the Baltimore Agreement was signed in September 13th, 1922, with 50 railroads signing initially, and then by the end of October, 126 railroads signed on. And so what that agreement included was all men were able to return to work at their current wages and conditions prior to the strike action. All seniority was to return to June 1922 conditions, and the men were to be called back to work in that order. And then all future labor disputes were to be arbitrated by a committee composed of 6 representatives to be named by the chief officers of the organizations and 6 railroad officers or representatives selected from and by the railroads agreeing to the agreement. I'm guessing that means 6 representatives chosen by either side. And both parties pledged themselves that no intimidation nor oppression would be practiced or permitted against any of the employees who have remained at work or have taken service, or against those who resume work under this understanding. So they really didn't gain much of anything at all. However, the workers did claim victory in regards to these open shop conditions, where the railroads did subcontract repair work to non-union labor. However, this wasn't really in the formalized Baltimore agreement. Like we said earlier, there were continued strike actions against the carriers that did not sign on to the agreement. And the repair issue became so urgent. A lot of the rail cars were just falling into disrepair and creating really dangerous conditions. So this continued labor pressure may have worked to reduce this non-union subcontracted labor that was engaged in this repair work in the shops.
Now, as I said earlier, one of the key features of this strike is that it's happening under a much less labor-friendly federal administration. And of course, the federal court system, as we talked about in our most recent episode, generally not very pro-labor at the time. So Kelly, could you talk a little bit about what federal intervention against this strike looked like, which was certainly a departure from, say, how things had been handled under the Wilson years, but was also a much more middle ground approach than, say, the late 19th century strikes in the rail industry?
Absolutely. I think that when thinking about whether the strikes were successful or not, one thing that struck me was that the unions continued to persist as powerful forces after this strike, which in its own way is a success, given the powerful forces that would have liked to see unions disappear completely. And some of those powerful forces were inside the federal government. On July 11th, this is less than 2 weeks into the strike, but President Harding, seeing that this was going to be a significant challenge for the nation's economy and just the moving things in general, he issued a proclamation that the workers and railway companies split the difference and meet in the middle. So essentially saying, like, figure it out, guys. Everyone has to make a compromise. Let's fix this. And this began some serious rounds of negotiation in which railroad officials pledged to stop subcontracting work to non-union shops, which was one of the reasons the strike began in the first place. However, they would not give ground on restoring seniority rights to striking railway workers. And this was a no-go for the unions. So nothing really came of these negotiations, despite President Harding's desire to apply some pressure and bring this to an end quickly. The U.S. Attorney General at the time was Harry Dougherty, who was a giant critic of unions and really sought to escalate the federal government's role in the issue. He sent U.S. Marshals into the field to protect the property of railway companies and to break up the strikes. He was really doing everything within his locus of control as Attorney General to make this a federal issue and to really use it as an opportunity to bring down unions in general. At the time, the Secretary of Commerce was Herbert Hoover and the Secretary of Labor was James John Davis. They both were more moderate in their approach to this particular strike, and they wanted a negotiated end to the strike, which was the approach that eventually won President Harding's endorsement. But Attorney General Dougherty certainly continued to do whatever he could and use whatever powers he had to bring this to an end and to damage unions in the process. And to give you an idea of how Attorney General Harry Dougherty used the Justice Department to damage unions and bring an end to the strike. On September 1st, a federal judge issued an injunction against striking, assembling, picketing, other union activities. It's kind of unimaginable the number of ways in which this violates people's guarantees of free speech and free assembly. But indeed, this injunction was issued, and it was colloquially called the Dougherty Injunction, and really gave heavily put the Justice Department's hand on the, you know, scales of justice as this strike continued.
As we said earlier, in terms of the timeline, the injunction happens on September 1st. Huge, sweeping injunction, obviously unconstitutional in what we would consider to be just instinctively unconstitutional, even if the federal courts say it's fine. And it, you know, in some ways took the wind out of the sails of the strike. In other ways, it motivated a whole bunch of unrelated unions to join in sympathy strikes in the, you know, mining sectors, agricultural sectors, and so forth. And they were able to at least put enough pressure on the situation to result in that Baltimore agreement that Rachel previously described that ended the strike with at least the union fully intact, everyone getting their jobs back with seniority, et cetera, even if they didn't get the core demands that they had wanted before the strike. Another thing to note here is using injunctions and so forth to limit or to try to limit strikes, even if people weren't necessarily following that, is a very different strategy and a much more middle ground strategy than, say, the approach taken with the Pullman strike or the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. Remember, with the Pullman strike, President Cleveland in the 1890s used his authority on the basis that the federal mail needed to be delivered on time by the railroads, and so therefore he could do whatever he needed to do to stop that strike and keep the trains moving. So he called up thousands of federal troops to physically operate the trains. You can imagine a scenario, even though it's a little bit different here because we're talking about the shop workers striking as opposed to the people operating the trains striking, you can imagine that the Harding administration could have potentially called up, you know, all of the mechanics in the National Guard or the U.S. Army or something like that, or people who had, you know, just served in World War One in various mechanic and repair roles, and they could have deployed them to, you know, keep the trains in good order and running smoothly and get that equipment repaired. That's a potential option they could have taken, a pathway they could have taken. Maybe they couldn't. Maybe there was some reason internally where they discussed that and decided it just wasn't feasible in the way that having troops called out to actually operate trains would be. But I think it's notable that that didn't happen in this case. So even though you had this pretty hostile to labor administration, they still didn't go as far as they might have in the past. So Kelly, one thing you wanted to emphasize was that although the strike basically wrapped up by the end of October in most places, there were certain areas where it continued beyond that.
Yes. And so the strike, it's hard to name an actual end to the strike just because it went on in different areas and for different reasons for quite a while. And the strike order was actually not ended by the union until 1928, 6 years after it began. But the impact, it stopped having an impact far before that. And one of the reasons was because railways were really ready to hire these strike breakers. There was an abundance of labor at the end of the war. And so pretty quickly, railways such as Penn Railroad hired people as strike breakers. The Penn Railroad was a particularly interesting example because they really wanted this to return to pre-war railways with no union activity involved. And ironically, because they did not take orders from the RLB, just sort of like philosophically speaking, they weren't interested in listening to the RLB, they did not enact the wage decrease that started the strike. And as a result, only about half of their workers participated. But they went all out to defeat the strike and spent a lot of money, probably more money than they would have spent just like placating, giving the strikers what they desired. In order to replace workers, develop spy networks, hire security guards, because their end goal was really to make this as ineffective as possible and get rid of unions altogether. And in a July 13th letter to the president of the Southern Pacific Railroad, I think the vice president of Penn Railroad outlined his strategy, which was, "Our organization plans are not different from the organization which we have set up at all times to cope with matters of this kind." So the Pennsylvania Railroad in each region established its own permanent strike organization, and all of the supervisory officers or people who are not in the union, because they were managerial, they immediately assumed their respective strike duties. And so in this way, Pennsylvania Railroad and other railroad organizations were able to staff the positions of people who are on strike fairly quickly, although oftentimes the people they hired actually did not have the skills to do the job that they were hired for, which led certainly to some safety and health concerns. But for this reason, and the negotiations, which were sort of initiated by President Harding, but then quickly halted sort of a few weeks later when nobody could find a resolution. The strike, which began in July, sort of continued on through July and August, and continued to have different effects in different regions, but did not formally end until 1928.
So, Rachel, I wanted to go to you now to talk about the IWW perspective on this. Obviously, we've talked recently about how the IWW at this point was kind of on the downswing and increasingly not really a force in American politics anymore for a variety of reasons, and you can check out those episodes. But I did think that their sort of internal membership publications from the time chart the sort of rise and fall of this strike in 1922. Obviously, they're coming at it with a specific perspective. They're not really super friendly all the time necessarily with the American Federation of Labor, but in this case, they were very supportive of the strike and very critical of the big four unions in the rail industry for not supporting the strike. So could you give us a sample of some of the headlines over the course of the strike and how they viewed from their sort of radical perspective on what went wrong with this strike?
Yeah. So, like you said, they weren't like formally involved in the strike, but they did provide some support. They did block strike breakers from getting onto trains and getting transported to the areas where the strike was most effective. So they did kind of provide some of that material support as well as this kind of media support. So this comes from a University of Washington archive of the IWW. I'm just going to read some of the headlines that they were writing at that time. So on July 29th, they said, "Rail strikes feel the need of solidarity. Surprising vigor of rank and file aids coal miners, big four still scabbing." So they were obviously talking about other labor actions that were happening at the time. August 5th, big four brotherhood scabs, curbing strike. No government inspection, repairs between stations, and scabs pay was being reduced. August 12th, hesitate over general strike. Brotherhoods threatened to walk out because of danger, decide to wait. So the big four, even though they weren't involved, they were affected by the strike just because of those health and safety issues that we talked about before. There wasn't any repairs happening in the shops. And so the big four did get involved in that there was some concerns on their part. And they did actually kind of threaten to walk out, but they basically decide not to. August 19th, rank and file drifting into rail strike, big four members quitting, union heads can't prevent, government hints arrests. So I think we've talked about this a lot, the rank and file being more radical than the union heads. So they were starting to get involved in the action, even though officially coming from the top of the unions, they weren't a part of the strike. August 26th, new conference in rail strike. September 2nd, trainmen would aid strike, but union leader threatens. Again, the rank and file going against the union heads. And then finally, October 21st, the IWW and the rails, how they could have won. And so that was just describing how the IWW kind of broke down what happened and what they would have done differently to hopefully accomplish their goals. That kind of sounds like Monday morning quarterbacking. I'm not sure how, given their reduction in power at that time, how they could have created a more effective strike.
This, of course, happened in 1922, the year before the 1923 maritime strike at San Pedro that we talked about on a recent episode, which sort of effectively ended the IWW. So they still had some amount of power, but they were certainly much reduced, especially after the crackdown on revolutionary trade union activity during World War I and immediately after. Now, there's a whole book on this 1922 shopman strike, which we didn't get a copy of. I don't even know how easy it is to get a copy of it. It's called Power at Odds, the 1922 National Railroad Shopman Strike by Colin J. Davis. And this was part of a series of publications called the Working Class in American History series from the University of Illinois Press in 1997. But you can read a 1998 book review from the State Historical Society of Iowa, and it mentions a few things that come up in the book, which seemed interesting. So Kelly mentioned about how the Pennsylvania Railroad was so aggressive, even to the point of spending huge amounts of money on strike-breaking activities during this action because they wanted to eliminate the unions from their railroad, as opposed to the other railroads that were willing to concede the existence of the unions even if they wouldn't give in to their demands. For every Pennsylvania Railroad worker on strike, there were two private guards hired by the railroad to counter them. Colin J. Davis also wrote a 2007 journal article, which I also couldn't figure out how to access, unfortunately, about this strike, but there was an interesting footnote on the first page, which I could see, which argued that the 1922 strike had a more direct and visible impact in more communities across the U.S. than the 1894 Pullman strike or the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. I think that's notable, as Kelly said earlier, because this was such a widespread strike that it's sometimes hard to find good accounts of this because you'd probably have to go look at local news coverage at the time, which was probably filled in many cases with propaganda paid for by the railroads. We certainly saw that happen in 1911. In our 1911 episode, because it was a much more geographically contained strike, we were able to basically get all of the local news sources from the time that we needed from newspapers in Illinois and Mississippi, the two sort of biggest focal points of that particular strike. But in this case, you'd probably have to go look at local newspapers in just about everywhere in the country. Davis's case that this was a more visible strike and a more widespread strike geographically than those two previous strikes does seem consistent with the contemporary views on the strike after it had collapsed. You can see that in, again, that December 1922 article that we've mentioned several times now in Monthly Labor Review by Margaret Gadsby, who described the strike at the time as, quote, the most expensive and complete tie-up of that branch of the railroad industry, i.e. rail shops, that this country has yet experienced. For practically 3 months, this strike has engrossed the attention of the country. For an even longer period, it has partially paralyzed the transportation facilities of the nation and endangered the safety of the traveling public, end quote, due to the, quote, deteriorating, unquote, condition of train equipment while the repair shops were on strike. She also alludes to the fact that coal wasn't moving due to sympathy strikes there and that fruit crops risked going bad. Again, I wasn't quite sure if that was agricultural laborers who were striking in solidarity or if it was just that there weren't enough trains moving to get those crops to market. But that sort of gives you an idea of how extensive this strike was. And that includes even after that court injunction. So Kelly, I wanted to talk now at the end of this episode in more direct comparison and contrast exercise with that 1911 Illinois Central strike and Harriman System strike by the shop workers. So one similarity we see is continued frustration with the outsourcing of shop work to non-union subcontractors, something which itself makes striking difficult to succeed. Because if there's enough outsourcing capacity, you can just outsource all of your repair work. In this case, it seems like the reason that they were able to at least reach a final compromise that kept the unions intact and kept everyone's jobs fully intact without actually winning concessions beyond that has to do with the size and scale of this strike. So it did not end in total disaster the way the 1911 strike did. I think it was probably too much to try to hire 400,000 replacement workers or outsource the jobs of 400,000 people to open shop subcontractors. So people did get their jobs back. But you can see that there is a similar frustration there in terms of the outsourcing, which again, the railroads argued, oh, well, that's just cost-saving measure, or we don't have enough internal capacity, or we need flexibility, or whatever. The same type of arguments that you hear with that kind of stuff today. Another thing we see, similarly, violent retaliation against the striking workers. ample use of state power and state guard troops to protect the strikebreakers. We also see, as Kelly mentioned, labor racism depending on the locations, which was something that you saw in 1911 as well, with attacks on black strikebreaking workers. And again, those tensions would have been avoided by having integrated unions and solidarity, racial solidarity, as well as class solidarity. And we did see in some locations in the country, as Kelly said, that there were solidarity actions by the black workers as well, who understood that their fates were tied into this too, even if some of the white workers didn't necessarily see that. We also talked a lot in 1911 about how when things sort of deteriorated pretty quickly with the strike and they realized it wasn't going their way, they kind of, because they didn't really have the leverage to, you know, hold out for getting all their jobs back, they tried to escalate the strike and that did not go anywhere. So, you know, they were repeatedly trying to get the other unions to come out on strike in support. They were trying to get a general strike of hundreds of thousands of workers, and that never really happened. We got a lot closer in this one with 400,000 people going on strike. At least it was basically the entire shopman's sector nationwide. But they still really did not have a lot of luck in activating the other railroad unions. And those are the people who actually operate the trains. And if they had come out, that would have paralyzed everything. And, you know, who knows, maybe that prompts a federal military intervention. But at least that would have supported the shopmen and potentially had the effect of winning the concessions that they wanted. But again, kind of doesn't seem like this was as disastrous as it could have been, right? You still have this 400,000 person strong union fully intact. Everyone got their jobs back with seniority. So it could have gone very differently. It could have gone more like what the Pennsylvania Railroad wanted, except across all these different railroads, and had everyone get fired and so forth and not get their jobs back. So Kelly, I wanted to go to you for your thoughts on, since you did the 1911 Illinois Central shopman strike with me, which was, you know, just over a decade prior to this. What sort of comparisons do you see and what differences do you see?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the quintessential problems here is just like the number of different unions and getting them all on the same page to really do sort of the massive national strike that would have been necessary for them to sort of get more of their demands. The 7 of the 16 railroad unions is certainly a sizable number, and 400,000 people participating. And I think it touched like 42 states across the United States. So this was not a small strike by any means. But with the abundance of labor at the moment, with the discrimination, the racial discrimination that the unions had certainly not reckoned with, and with just the number of unions not participating, the railways were able to sort of cover up the strikers and lead to a less successful strike. But it was quite a powerful show of force, and it certainly did disrupt the day-to-day operations, especially in those initial months as railways spent quite a bit of money hiring those workers to replace the strikers, and generally disrupted operations since many of the people they hired did not actually know how to do those jobs. Again, it seems like without some sort of solidarity of workers amongst the railroads, they weren't quite as successful as they hoped to be. But like I mentioned earlier, there were some seriously powerful forces in the federal government, in the railways themselves, that really wanted this to be the end of unions. And so the fact that it remains a point in history that shows the strength of unions and was not a part of the historical demise of unions, I think is something that we can't overstate.
Rachel, I wanted to get your thoughts on sort of the summary takeaways of this. Again, there's sort of this debate as to whether or not this was a failed strike or a stalemate or even some kind of victory.
So I think one important thing that just kind of jumped out at me is how like little power the Railway Labor Board actually had, or the Railroad Labor Board. The big railroads could basically just ignore them, like with the Pennsylvania Railroad. So I think that's something that, like, if we're talking about like the federal level, the national review boards that we that exist today, they really just don't have a lot of teeth. They just don't have a lot of regulatory power. And so then big businesses and big, in this case, the railroads that were big, could just ignore them and just kind of just nah, just say nah, and kind of do their own thing, whether it was ignoring the wage decreases in the first place or just doing everything in their power to just ignore the attempted mediation that they tried to go through. So I think that's something that we really need to look forward to it today as well. The National Labor Review Board doesn't have a lot of power, and we are in the midst of a very anti-labor, anti-worker sentiment on the national level. So that even more takes away from the power of the NLRB. So I think we need to bring in more pro-labor, pro-worker elected officials, so then we can get more power in those review boards.
Also, one thing we talked about on our most recent bonus episode about the Adamson Act, which of course created various labor protections like the 8-hour workday for the people who were actually operating the trains, the train crews themselves, as opposed to the people repairing the train equipment, is that, you know, you got a bit of a chicken and egg thing where you need to have strong unions to get strong federal protections, but strong federal protections and interventions on the side of labor also create labor strength too, at least in this country. One of the things that seems relevant here is that the big four brotherhoods didn't seem to feel much need to go on strike because they had gotten what they wanted. Now, you can dismiss that in terms of saying labor aristocracy and so forth, but it does seem to have played a role. They got what they wanted in 1916 and didn't feel a particular need to go on strike. And I guess they weren't affected by the wage reductions either. And that obviously is a significant factor. And one of the reasons they probably weren't is because of that specific federal legislation governing them. But on the other hand, what we also see is that how do you go from a situation like in 1911, where you have pretty low density of union membership in these shops? In fact, one of the factors that we talked about in the 1911 strike was that they were going on strike to force recognition of this large system-wide union, to then, after World War I, having this 400,000 person sectoral union representing almost every shop worker in the entire rail industry. And the answer is very simple. It's that the federal government had nationalized the railroads into one system temporarily during World War I. And that is what allowed the integration under a labor-friendly administration of all of these unions under the aegis of the American Federation of Labor to cover all of these different railroads in one big union, kind of like what the IWW had dreamed of, at least on the sectoral level. Again, we're still seeing that inter-craft tensions problem that we've talked about on many episodes. But at least within that one sector, they got this one big union. And so if you want to talk about chicken and the egg, having that huge federal intervention that allowed for the creation of this big union is the key thing. And even if this strike was a failure in terms of achieving its strategic goals that prompted the strike, it was a success in that it kept the unions alive and around, even under an unfriendly administration. Whereas, as you said, Rachel, this could have been the end for that union, right? This could have been the thing that just said, all right, we're back to the pre-war conditions, no unionization, no widespread unionization, and so forth. And they managed to not be strong enough to get the things they were demanding, but also not to just completely roll over either. And that seems like an important distinction. All right, Rachel, thank you so much for being on the episode this week.
Thanks for having me.
And Kelly, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me, Bill.